for me than the day I was promoted to corporal in the United States Army, because I knew I wasn't that tough, just desperate. I taught my classes. I was so uncertain about teaching, I thought of simply spending my life at port warehouses, big fish, small pond. My bosses would be so impressed with my college degree, they'd hire me as a checker and promote me to an office job where I'd surely rise in the world. I might become boss of all checkers. I knew how it was with warehouse office workers or office workers anywhere. They pushed papers around, yawned, looked out the window at us, slaving away on the platform. I did not tell my classes about Helena, the telephone woman who offered more than donuts in the back of the warehouse. I was tempted till Eddie said, "If you even brushed against her, you'd wind up at St. Vincent's Hospital with a dripping dick." What I missed about the peers was the way people spoke their minds and didn't give a shit. Not like the college professors who would tell you on the one hand yes, on the other hand no, and you didn't know what to think. It was important to know what professors thought so you could give it back to them at exam time. In the warehouses, everyone insulted everyone else in a joking way till someone stepped over the line and the hooks came out. It was remarkable when that happened. You could see from the way the laughs faded and the smiles got tighter that some big mouth was getting too close to the bone, and you knew the next thing was the hook or the fist. Work stopped when fights broke out on piers and loading docks. Eddie told me men got tired of lifting and hauling and stacking. Same damn thing year in, year out. And that's why they insulted and pushed one another to the edge of a real fight. They had to do something to break the routine and the long silent hours. I told him I didn't mind working all day and not saying a word. And he said, "Yeah, but you're peculiar. You're only here a year and a half. If you did this 15 years, your mouth would be going too." Some of these guys fought in Normandy in the Pacific, and what are they now? Donkeys. Donkeys with purple hearts already. Pathetic donkeys in a dead end. They get drunk over on Hudson Street and brag about their medals, as if the world gives a shit. They'll tell you they're working for the kids, the kids, the kids, a better life for the kids. Jesus, I'm glad I never got married. If Eddie hadn't been there, the fights would have been worse. He was the man with eye and ear on everything, and he could sniff trouble in the wind. If two men started to go at it, Eddie would stick his great belly between them, tell them to get the hell off his platform and finish their fight in the street, which they never did because they were really grateful for the excuse to avoid the fist, and especially the hook. You can handle a fist, but you never know where a hook is coming from. Still, they'd keep on muttering and giving each other the finger. But it was all gas now because the moment had passed. The challenge was over, the rest of us were back at work, and what's the use of a fight if there's no one to see what a killer you are? Helena came from the office to watch the fights, and when they were over, she'd whisper to the winners and invite them to a dark place in the warehouse for a nice time. Eddie said some of those rotten bastards pretended to fight so Helena would be nice to them, and if he ever saw me in the back with her after a fight, he'd throw my ass in the river. He said that because of the time I had a fight, or nearly had a fight with the driver, Fat Dominic, who was dangerous because of rumors he was connected to the mob. Eddie said that was bullshit. If you were really connected, you weren't driving and breaking your ass unloading rigs. The rest of us believed Dominic probably knew people who were connected, or even made, so it was a good idea to cooperate with him. But how could you cooperate when he sneered, "What's the matter, Paddy? Can't talk? Maybe a dummy humped your mama, huh?" Everyone knows that on the docks or the platforms, or anywhere, you're never to let anyone insult your mother. Kids know it from the time they're able to talk. You might not even like your mother, but that doesn't matter. They can say anything they like about you, but insulting your mother is pushing it. And if you let it go, you lose all respect. If you need someone to help with the load on the platform or the pier, they'll turn their backs. You don't exist. They won't even share a liver or sandwich with you at lunchtime. If you wander around the docks and the warehouses and you see men eating alone, you know they're in deep shit, men who tolerated insults to their mothers, or once scabbed across a picket line. A scab can be forgiven in a year, but never a man who allowed an insult to his mother. I got back at Dominic with an army insult. "Hey, Dominic, you're such a fat slob. When was the last time you saw your dick, and how do you know it's really there?" He swung around and knocked me off the platform with the flat of his fist. And when I hit the street, I lost control and jumped back on the platform, clawing at him with my hook. He had the smile now, the one that says, "You poor miserable shit, you're gonna die." And when I lunged at him, he pushed my face away with the palm of his hand and knocked me to the street again. The palm of the hand is the most insulting thing in a fight. A punch with a closed fist is a straightforward, honorable thing. It's what boxers do. But the palm in the face says you're beneath contempt, and you'd rather have two black eyes than sink beneath contempt. The black eyes will clear up, but the other thing is there forever. Then he added insult to insult. When I grabbed the edge of the platform to pull myself back up, he stepped on my hand and spat on my head, and that sent me into such a white rage, I swung my hook and caught him in the back of the leg and pulled till he yelled, "You little shit! I see blood on my leg, you're dead!" There was no sign of blood. The hook was deflected by the thick leather of his work boots, but I was ready to keep swiping for flesh till Eddie rushed down the steps and pushed me away. "Give me that hook. You are one crazy Mick. Get on the bad side of Dominic and you are shit in the street." He told me, "Get inside, change my clothes, leave by another door, go home, get the hell out of here." "Will I be fired?" "No, you won't, goddammit. We can't fire everyone who has a fight here, but you'll lose half a day's pay we have to slip to Dominic." "Why should I lose to Dominic? He started it." "Dominic brings us business and you're passing through. You'll be graduating from college and he'll still be driving in loads. You're lucky to be alive, kid, so take your lumps and go home. Think about it." On my way out, I looked back to see if Helena was there. And she was, with that little come-hither smile. But Eddie was there too, and I knew there was no hope of going to the dark place with her, with Eddie glaring. Someday, when it was my turn on the forklift, I'd get revenge on Fat Dominic. I'd hit the pedal and jam the fat one against the wall and listen to him scream. That was my dream. But it never happened, and that's because everything changed between him and me the day he backed in his rig and called to Eddie from the cab. "Hey, Eddie, who you got unloading today?" "Durkin." "Nah, don't give me Durkin. Give me Big Mouth Mick with the hook." "Dominic, are you crazy? Let it go." "Nah, just give me Big Mouth." Eddie asked me if I could handle it. If I didn't want to, I didn't have to. He said, "Dominic's not the boss around here." I said I could handle any fat slob, and Eddie told me, "Cut it out. Christ sakes, watch your mouth. We're not going to bail you out again. Get to work and watch the mouth." Dominic was up on the platform, unsmiling. He said this was a real job, cases of Irish whiskey, and there might be a drop case along the way. Oh, one or two bottles might be broken, but the rest were for us, and he was sure we could handle it. There was a fast little smile, and I felt too embarrassed to smile back. How could a man smile after he used the palm of his hand on me instead of his fist? "Christ, you're one gloomy Mick," he said. I was going to call him a wop, but I didn't want the palm of his hand again. He talked in a cheerful way as if nothing had ever happened between us. That puzzled me because whenever I had a quarrel or fight with someone, I turned away from them for a long time. We loaded pallets with the cases, and he told me in a normal way his first wife was Irish, but she died of TB. Can you imagine that? T-damn-B. Lousy cook, my first wife, like the rest of the Irish. Don't get offended, kid. Don't give me the look. But boy, could she sing. Opera stuff, too. Now I'm married to an Italian. Don't have a knot in her head, but boy, can she cook. He stared at me. She feeds me. That's why I'm a fat slob. Can't see his knees. I smiled and he called to Eddie. "Hey, asshole, you owe me 10. I made the little Mick smile. We finished unloading and stacked the pallets inside, and it was time to drop a case of whiskey for breakage and sit on bags of peppers in the fumigation room with truckers and warehouse men and make sure nothing from that case was wasted. Eddie was the kind of man you'd like to have for a father. He explained things to me when we sat on the platform bench between loads. When he explained things to me, I was puzzled. I didn't know these things already. I was supposed to be the college boy, but he knew more, and I had more respect for him than I had for any professor. His own life was a dead end. He took care of his father, who came out of World War I shell-shocked. Eddie could have put him in a veterans' hospital, but he said they were hell holes. While Eddie worked, a woman came in every day and fed his father and cleaned him. In the evening, Eddie wheeled him to the park, then home to watch the news on television. And that was Eddie's life. He didn't complain. He just said it was always his dream to have children, but it wasn't in the cards. His father was gone in the head, but his body was sound. He'd live forever, and Eddie would never have the place to himself. He chain-smoked on the platform and ate huge meatball sandwiches, washed down with pints of chocolate malted. The cigarette cough got him one day when he was yelling at Fat Dominic to straighten out that damn rig and back it in. "You drive like a Hoboken whore!" And when the cough came, it tangled with the laugh, and he couldn't catch his breath, and collapsed on the platform with the cigarette still in his mouth, Fat Dominic in the cab of his rig yelling insults at him till he saw Eddie turning whiter than white and gasping for air. By the time Fat Dominic had heaved out of the cab and up the platform, Eddie was gone. And instead of coming over to him and talking the way they talk to the dead in the movies, Fat Dominic backed away and waddled down the steps to his truck, weeping like a great fat whale, and driving away, forgetting he had a load to deliver. I stayed with Eddie till the ambulance took him away. Helena came from the office and told me I looked terrible and sympathized with me as if Eddie were my father. I told her I was ashamed of myself because no sooner was Eddie out of sight than I thought I might apply for his job. I said I could do it, couldn't I? I was a college graduate. Oh, she told me the boss would hire me in a minute. He'd be proud to say Port Warehouses had the only college graduate checker and platform boss on the waterfront. She said, sit there at Eddie's desk to get used to it, and write a note to the boss saying I was interested in the job. Eddie's clipboard was on the desk. It still held the manifest from Fat Dominic. A red pencil hung by a string from the clip. A coffee mug half filled with black coffee sat on the desk. The coffee mug said Eddie on the side. I thought I'd have to get a mug like that with Frank printed on it. Helena would know where to buy it. It gave me a feeling of comfort to think she might be there to help. She said, what are you waiting for? Write the note. I looked at Eddie's coffee mug again. I looked out at the platform where he had fallen and died, and I could not write the note. Helena said this was the opportunity of a lifetime. I'd make $100 a week, for God's sakes, up from the lousy 77 I made now. No, I could never take Eddie's place on that platform. Didn't have his generosity of belly and heart. Helena said, okay, okay, you're right. What's the use of a college education? You're just going to stand on the platform checking off sacks of peppers. Any dropper can do that, no offense to Eddie. You want to be another Eddie, spend your life checking Fat Dominic? You just go be a teacher, honey, you'll get more respect. Was it the coffee mug and the little push from Helena that got me off the waterfront and into the classroom? Or was it my conscience telling me, face it, stop hiding, and teach, man? When I told stories about the docks, they looked at me in a different way. One boy said it was funny to think you had a teacher up there that worked like real people and didn't come from college just talking about books and all. He used to think he'd like to work in the piers too because of all the money you make on overtime and little deals here and there with the drop broken goods, but his father said he'd break his ass, ha ha, and you didn't talk back to your father in an Italian family. His father said, if this Irishman can get to be a teacher, so can you, Ronnie, so can you, so forget the docks. You might make money. But what good is that when you can't straighten your back? Long after my teaching days, I scribble numbers on pieces of paper, and I'm impressed by what they mean. In New York, I taught in 5 different high schools and 1 college. McKee Vocational and Technical High School, Staten Island, the High School of Fashion Industries in Manhattan, Seward Park High School in Manhattan, Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, night classes at Washington Irving High School in Manhattan, New York Community College in Brooklyn. I taught by day, by night, and in summer school. My arithmetic tells me that about 12,000 boys and girls, men and women, sat at desks and listened to me lecture, chant, encourage, ramble, sing, declaim, recite, preach, dry up. I think of the 12,000 and wonder what I did for them. Then I think of what they did for me. The arithmetic tells me I conducted at least 33,000 classes. 33,000 classes in 30 years, days, nights, summers. In universities, you can lecture from your old crumbling notes. In public high schools, you'd never get away with it. American teenagers are experts in the tricks of teachers, and if you try to hoodwink them, they'll bring you down. So, yo, teacher man, what else happened in Ireland? I can't talk about that now. We have to cover the vocabulary chapter in the textbook. Open to page 72. Aw, man, you tell the other class of stories. Can't you tell us just one little thing? Okay, one little thing. When I was a boy in Limerick, I never thought I'd grow up to be a teacher in New York. We were poor. Oh, yeah? We heard you didn't have no refrigerator. Right. And we had no toilet paper. What? No toilet paper? Everybody has toilet paper. Even in China, where everybody's starving, they have toilet paper. Even Africa. They think I'm exaggerating, and they don't like it. There's a limit to hard luck stories. You tried to tell us you go and pull your pants up and not wipe yourself? Nancy Castigliano raises her hand. Excuse me, Mr. McCourt, it's nearly lunchtime, and I don't want to hear no more about people having no toilet paper. Okay, Nancy, we'll move on. Facing dozens of teenagers every day brings you down to earth. At 8 a.m., they don't care how you feel. You think of the day ahead. 5 classes, up to 175 American adolescents, moody, hungry, in love, anxious, horny, energetic, challenging, no escape. There they are. And there you are with your headache, your indigestion, echoes of your quarrel with your spouse, lover, landlord, your pain-in-the-ass son who wants to be Elvis, who appreciates nothing you do for him. You couldn't sleep last night. You still have that bag filled with the papers of the 175 students, their so-called compositions, careless scrawls. Oh, mister, did you read my paper? Not that they care. Writing compositions is not how they intend to spend the rest of their lives. That's something you do only in this boring class. They're looking at you. You cannot hide. They're waiting. What are we going to do today, teacher? The paragraph. Oh, yeah. Hey, everybody, we're going to study the paragraph, the structure, topic, sentence, and all. Can't wait to tell my mom tonight. She's always asking how was school today. Paragraphs, Mom. Teacher has a thing about paragraphs. Mom will say, very nice, and go back to her soap opera. They straggle in from auto mechanic shop, the real world, where they break down and reassemble everything from Volkswagens to Cadillacs. And here's this teacher going on about the parts of a paragraph. Jesus, man, you don't need paragraphs in an auto shop. If you bark or snap, you lose them. That's what they get from parents and the schools in general, the bark and the snap. If they strike back with the silent treatment, you're finished in the classroom. Their faces change. And they have a way of deadening their eyes. Tell them, open their notebooks. They stare. They take their time. Yeah, they'll open their notebooks. Yes, sir. Here we go, opening our notebooks, nice and easy, so nothing falls out. Tell them, copy what's on the board. They stare. Oh, yeah, they tell one another. He wants us to copy what's on the board. Look at that. Man wrote something on the board and wants us to copy it. They shake their heads in slow motion. You ask, are there any questions? And all around the room, there is the innocent look. You stand and wait. They know it's a 40-minute showdown, you versus them. 34 New York teenagers, the future mechanics and craftsmen of America. You're just another teacher, man, so what are you going to do? Stare down the whole class? Fail the whole class? Get with it, baby. They have you by the balls, and you created the situation, man. You didn't have to talk to them like that. They don't care about your mood, your headaches, your troubles. They have their own problems, and you are one of them. Watch your step, teacher. Don't make yourself a problem. They'll cut you down. Rain changes the mood of the school, mutes everything. The first class comes in silently. One or two say good morning. They shake drops from their jackets. They're in a dream state. They sit and wait. No one talks, no requests for the pass, no complaints, no challenges, no back talk. Rain is magic, rain is king. Go with it, teacher man. Take your time, lower your voice. Don't even think about teaching English. Forget about taking attendance. This is the mood of a house after a funeral. No harsh headlines today, no cruel news from Vietnam. Outside the room, a footfall, a laugh from a teacher, rain clatters against windows. Sit at your desk and let the hours slip by. A girl raises her hand. She says, "Ah, Mr. McCourt, you ever in love?" You're new, but you know already when they ask questions like that, they're thinking of themselves. You say, "Yes." Did she give you up or did you give her up? Both. Oh, yeah? You mean you were in love more than once? Yes. Wow. A boy raises his hand. He says, "Why can't teachers treat us like human beings?" You don't know. Well, man, if you don't know, tell them. I don't know. Tell them about school in Ireland. You went to school in a state of terror. You hated it and dreamed of being 14 and getting a job. You never thought about your own school days like this before, never talked about it. You wished this rain would never stop. They're in their seats. No one had to tell them hang up their jackets. They're looking at you as if they had just discovered you. It should rain every day. Or there are spring days when heavy clothing is discarded and each class is a vista of breasts and biceps. Little zephyrs wafting through the windows caress the cheeks of teachers and students, send smiles from desk to desk, from row to row, till the room is all adazzle. Pigeon coo and sparrow chirp tell us, "Be of good cheer, summer is a-coming in." Those shameless pigeons, indifferent to the teen throb in my room, copulate on the windowsill. And that is more seductive than the best lesson by the greatest teacher in the world. On days like this, I feel I could teach the toughest of the tough, the brightest of the bright. I could hug and cocker the saddest of the sad. On days like this, there is background music with hints of zephyr, breast, bicep, smile, and summer. And if my students ever wrote like that, I'd send them to simplicity school. Twice a year at McKee, we had open school day and open school night when parents visited the school to see how the children were faring. Teachers sat in classrooms talking to parents or listening to the complaints. Most visiting parents were mothers because that was the job of the woman. If the mother found her son or daughter was misbehaving or not performing well, then it would be up to the father to take steps. Of course, the father would take steps only with the son. The daughter was a matter for the mother. It wouldn't be right for a father to knock his daughter around the kitchen or tell her she was grounded for a month. Certain problems belong to the mother. Also, they had to decide on how much information to give the father. If the son was doing poorly and she had a violent husband, she might soften her story so that her boy would not wind up on the floor with blood streaming from his nose. Sometimes a whole family might come to visit the teacher, and the room would be packed with fathers and mothers and small children running up and down the aisles. The women talked to one another in a friendly way, but the men sat quietly at desks that could barely accommodate their size. No one ever told me how to handle parents on open school day. My first time at McKee, I had a student monitor, Norma, who gave out numbers so that parents would know who was next. First, I had to deal with the problem of my accent, especially with the women. Soon as I opened my mouth, they'd say, "Oh my God, what a cute brogue." Then they'd tell me how their grandparents came from the old country, how they came here with nothing, and now own their own gas station out in Newdorp. They wanted to know how long I was in this country and how I got into teaching. They said it was wonderful I was a teacher because most of our people were cops and priests. And they'd whisper, there were too many Jews in the school. They'd send their kids to Catholic schools, except the Catholic schools were not known for vocational or technical training. It was all history and prayers, which was all right for the next war, but their kids had to think about this world. No disrespect intended. Finally, they'd ask, how was he doing, the little Harry? I had to be careful if the dad was sitting there. If I made negative comments about Harry, the dad might go home and punch him, and word would get out to my other students that I was not to be trusted. I was learning that teachers and kids have to stick together in the face of parents, supervisors, and the world in general. I said positive things about all my students. They were attentive, punctual, considerate, eager to learn, and every one of them had a bright future. And the parents should be proud. Dad and Mom would look at each other and smile and say, see? Or they'd be puzzled and say, you talking about our kid? Our Harry? Oh yes, Harry. Does he behave himself in class? Is he respectful? Oh yes, he contributes to all our discussions. Oh yeah? That's not the Harry we know. He must be different in school because at home he's a regular little shit, excuse the language. Home, we can't get a word out of him. Can't get him to do nothing. All he wants to do is sit and listen to that goddamn rock and roll day and night, day and goddamn night. The dad was vehement. It's the worst thing ever happened to this country. With that Elvis shaking his ass all over television, excuse the language. I'd hate to have a daughter in this day and age watching that crap. Got a good mind to throw that phonograph in the garbage. I dumped the TV too, but I gotta have a little relaxation at the end of the day in the piers, know what I mean? Other parents became impatient and inquired sarcastically, polite, if there was a possibility I could get away from discussions of Elvis Presley and talk to them about their sons and daughters. Harry's parents informed them it was their turn to see about their kid. It was a free country, last they'd heard, and they weren't going to be cut off in the middle of their interview with this nice teacher from the old country. But the other parents say, yeah, yeah, teacher, hurry it up. We don't got all night. We're working people, too. I didn't know what to do. I thought if I said thank you to the parents at the desk, they might get the hint and go, but the vehement dad said, hey, we're not finished. Norma, my student monitor, understood my dilemma and took charge. She announced to the parents that if they wanted longer interviews with me, they could make appointments to see me on a series of afternoons. I never told Norma any such thing. I didn't want to spend my life in that classroom day after day with disgruntled parents, but she went calmly on, passed her on the sheet of paper, told the disgruntled ones to print, please print, don't write their names and phone numbers, and Mr. McCourt would be in touch. The rumbling subsided, and everyone complimented Norma on her efficiency and told her she should be a teacher herself. She told them she had no intention of being a teacher. Her big dream was to work in a travel agency and get free tickets everywhere. One mother said, oh, don't you want to settle down and have kids? You'd be a great mother. Then Norma said the wrong thing, and tension was back in the room. No, she said, I don't want kids. Kids are a pain. You have to change their diapers and then come to school to see how they're doing, and you're never free. She wasn't supposed to talk like that, and you could feel the hostility toward her rising in the room. A few minutes ago, parents were complimenting her on her efficiency, and now they felt insulted by her remarks on parenthood and kids. One father tore up the sheet of paper she'd handed off for names and phone numbers. He threw it toward the front of the room where I sat. Hey, he said, somebody dumped that in the garbage. He picked up his coat and told his wife, let's get out of here, this place is a nut house. His wife barked at me. Don't you have no control over these kids? This one was my daughter, I'd break her face. She got no right to insult the mothers of America like that. My face felt like a fire. I wanted to apologize to the parents in the room and the mothers of America. I wanted to tell Norma, go away. You've ruined my first open school day. She stood by the door, coolly saying goodnight to the parents who left, ignoring the way they glared at her. Now, what was I supposed to do? Where was the book by a professor of education that would help? 15 parents still sat in the room waiting to hear about their sons and daughters. What should I say to them? Norma spoke again, and my heart began to sink. Ladies and gentlemen, that was a dumb thing I said, and I'm sorry. It wasn't Mr. McCourt's fault. He's a good teacher. He's new, you know. just here a few months, so he's just a learning teacher. I should have kept my mouth shut because I got him in trouble, and I'm sorry. Then she began to cry, and a number of mothers rushed to comfort her while I sat at my desk. It was Norma's job to call the parents up one by one, but she was surrounded by that group of comforting mothers, and I didn't know if I should act independently and say, "Next." The parents seemed more interested in Norma's plight than in the future of their own children, and when the bell rang to signal the end of the meeting, they smiled and left, saying it was nice this visit with me and good luck in my teaching career. Polly's mother may have been right. On my second open school day, she told me I was a fraud. She was proud of her Polly, future plumber, nice kid, who wanted to start his own business someday, marry a nice girl, raise a family, and stay out of trouble. I should have been indignant and asked her who the hell she thought she was talking to, but at the back of my head, there was always a nagging doubt I was teaching under false pretenses. I asked my kid what he learned in school, and he tells me stories about Ireland, and you come to New York. Stories, stories, stories. You know what you are? A fraud. A goddamn fraud. And I'm saying that with the best intentions, trying to help. I wanted to be a good teacher. I wanted the approval that would come when I sent my students home stuffed with spelling and vocabulary, and all that would lead to a better life, but mea culpa, I didn't know how. The mother said she was Irish, married to an Italian, and she could see right through me. Right off, she knew my game. When I told her I agreed with her, she said, "Ooh, you agree with me. You actually know you're a fraud." "I'm just trying to make my way." They asked me questions about my life, and I answered because they won't listen when I tried to teach English. They look out the window, they doze, they nibble on sandwiches, they ask for the pass. You could teach them what they're supposed to learn, spelling in the big words. My son Polly has to go out in the world, and what's he going to do when he can't spell and use the big words, eh? I told Polly's mother that someday I hoped to be a master teacher, confident in the classroom. In the meantime, I could only keep trying. That somehow made her emotional and brought on the tears. She rooted around in her handbag for a handkerchief, and took so long I offered her mine. She shook her head. She said, "Who does your laundry?" "That handkerchief, Jesus! I wouldn't wipe my ass with that handkerchief. You a bachelor or what?" "I am." "I could tell from the look of that handkerchief, the saddest-looking grey handkerchief I ever seen in my life. That's bachelor grade, is what it is. Your shoes, too. I never seen such sad shoes. No woman would ever let you buy shoes like them. Easy to see you was never married." She wiped her cheek with the back of her hand. "You think my Polly can spell handkerchief?" "I don't think so. It's not on the list." "See what I mean? You people are out of it. You don't have handkerchief on the list, and he'll be blowing his nose the rest of his life. And you know what you got on that list? Usufruct, for Christ's sake. Usufruct. Who came up with that one? That one of those words you throw around at your fancy cocktail parties in Manhattan? Now what in hell is Polly going to do with a word like that? And here's another one, CONDIGN. I asked 6 people if they knew what that meant. I even asked an assistant principal in the hallway. He pretended he knew, but you could see he was talking through his ass. Plumber. My kid's going to be a plumber and charge big money to make house calls, just like a doctor, so I don't see why he needs to clog his head with $20 words like usufruct and the other one, do you? I said you have to be careful what you fill your head with. My own head was so packed with stuff from Ireland and the Vatican, I could hardly think for myself. She said she didn't care what was in my head. That was my own damn business, and I should really keep it to myself. Every day my Polly comes home telling us these stories, and we don't need to hear them. We got our own troubles. She said it was easy to see I was just off the boat, all innocent like a little sparrow that fell out of a nest. No, I'm not just off the boat. I was in the army. How could I be innocent? I had all kinds of jobs. I worked in the docks. I graduated from New York University. See, she said, that's what I mean. I ask you a simple question, and you give me the story of your life. That's what you want to watch, Mr. McCurd. These kids don't need to know the life story of every teacher in the school. I went to the nuns. They wouldn't give you the time of day. You ask them about their lives, they tell you mind your own business, pull you up by the ears, crack you across the knuckles. Stick to the spelling and the words, Mr. McCourt, and the parents of this school will thank you forever. Forget the storytelling. If we want stories, we got a TV guide and the Reader's Digest at home. I struggled. I thought I'd like to be a tough, no-nonsense English teacher, stern and scholarly, allowing an occasional laugh, but no more. Old-timers in the teacher's cafeteria told me, "The little bastards have to be kept under control. Give them an inch, kid, and you'll never get it back." Organization is everything. I would start all over. Draw up a plan for each class that would account for every minute left in the term. I was master of this vessel, and I would set a course. They'd sense my purpose. They'd know where they were going and what was expected of them. Or else. Or else. "Yeah, mister, that's what all the teachers say, or else. We thought you were going to be different, being Irish and all." Time to take charge. "Enough," I said. "Forget this Irish thing. No more stories, no more nonsense. English teacher is going to teach English and won't be stopped by little teenage tricks. Take out your notebooks." That's right, your notebooks. I wrote on the board, "John went to the store." A class groan traveled the room. "What is he doing to us? English teachers, all the same. Here he goes again. Old John to the store. Grammar, for Christ's sakes." "All right. What's the subject of this sentence? Does anyone know the subject of this sentence?" "Yes, Mario." "It's all about this guy wants to go to the store. Anyone can see that." "Yes, yes, that's what the sentence is about. But what is the subject?" "It's one word." "Yes, Donna?" "I think Mario is right. It's all about..." "No, Donna, the subject here is one word." "How come?" "What do you mean, how come? Aren't you taking Spanish? Don't you have grammar in Spanish? Doesn't Miss Grover tell you the parts of a sentence?" "Yeah, but she's not always bothering us with John going to the store." My head feels hot and I want to shout, "Why are you so damn stupid? Did you ever have a grammar lesson before? Christ in heaven, even I had grammar lessons, and in Irish. Why do I have to struggle here this sunny morning while spring birds chirp outside? Why do I have to look at your sullen, resentful face as you sit here, your belly stuffed, you're well clothed and warm, you're getting a free high school education, and you're not the slightest bit grateful? All you have to do is cooperate, participate a little, learn the parts of a sentence. Jesus, is that asking too much?" There are days I'd love to walk out of here, slam the door behind me, tell the principal shove this job up his arse, head down the hill to the ferry, sail to Manhattan, walk the streets, have a beer and a hamburger at the White Horse, sit in Washington Square, watch luscious NYU coeds saunter by, forget McKee Vocational and Technical High School forever, forever. It's clear I can't teach the simplest thing without their objections, their resistance, simple sentence, subject, predicate, and maybe, if we get around to it someday, the object, direct and indirect. I don't know what to do with them. Try the old threats. Pay attention or you're going to fail. If you fail, you won't graduate, and if you don't graduate, blah, blah, blah. All your friends will be out there in the big wide world, pinning their high school diplomas to their office walls, successful, respected by one and all. Why can't you just look at this sentence and for once in your miserable teenage existence make an attempt to learn? Every class has its chemistry. There are some classes you enjoy and look forward to. They know you like them, and they like you in return. Sometimes they'll tell you, "That was a pretty good lesson," and you're on top of the world. That somehow gives you energy and makes you want to sing on the way home. There are some classes you wish would take the ferry to Manhattan and never return. There's something hostile about the way they enter and leave the room that tells you what they think of you. It could be your imagination, and you try to figure out what will bring them over to your side. You try lessons that work with other classes, but even that doesn't help, and it's because of that chemistry. They know when they have you on the run. They have instincts that detect your frustrations. There were days I wanted to sit behind my desk and let them do whatever they damn well pleased. I just could not reach them. 4 years on the job in 1962 and I didn't care anymore. I told myself I never cared in the first place. You entertain them with stories of your miserable childhood. They make all those phony sounds. Oh, poor Mr. McCourt must have been awful growing up in Ireland like that, as if they cared. No, they're never satisfied. I should have followed the advice of old-timer teachers to keep my big mouth shut. Tell them nothing. They just use you. They figure you out and move in on you like heat-seeking missiles. They find out where you're vulnerable. Could they possibly know that John went to the store is as far as I can go on grammar? Lead me not into gerunds, dangling participles, cognate objects. I will surely be lost. I gave them the grim look, sat at my desk. Enough. I couldn't continue the charade of a grammar teacher. I said, why did John go to the store? They looked surprised. Yo, man, what's this? That has nothing to do with grammar. I'm asking you a simple question. Nothing to do with grammar. Why did John go to the store? Can't you guess? A hand in the back of the room. Yes, Ron? I think John went to the store to get a book on English grammar. And why did John go to the store to get a book on English grammar? 'Cause he wanted to know everything and come in here and impress good old Mr. McCourt. And why would he want to impress good old Mr. McCourt? 'Cause John has a girlfriend named Rose, and she's a good girl, knows all kinds of grammar, and she's going to graduate and be a secretary in a big company in Manhattan, and John don't want to be no dumbass trying to marry Rose. And that's why he goes to the store to get the book on grammar. He's going to be a good boy and study his book, and when he don't understand something, he's going to ask Mr. McCourt, because Mr. McCourt knows everything, and when John marries Rose, he's going to invite Mr. McCourt to the wedding and ask Mr. McCourt to be godfather to their first child, which would be called Frank after Mr. McCourt. Thank you, Ron. The class erupted, cheering, applauding, but Ron was not stopping. His hand went up again. Yes, Ron. When John got to the store, he didn't have no money, so he had to rob the book on grammar. But when he tried to walk out of the store, he was stopped, and the cops were called, and now he's in Sing Sing, and poor old Rose is crying her eyes out. They made sympathetic sounds. Poor Rose. The boys wanted to know where she could be found, and they'd be willing to stand in for John. Girls dabbed at their eyes till Kenny Ball, class tough guy, said it was only a story, and what was all this bullshit anyway? He said, teacher writes a sentence on the board, and the next thing, the guy's going to the store, robs a book, and winds up in Sing Sing. Whoever heard such bull, and is this an English class or what? Ron said, well, I guess you can do better, right? All these made-up stories don't mean nothing, don't help you get a job. The bell rang. They left, and I erased from the board, John went to the store. Next day, Ron raised his hand again. Hey, teacher, what would happen if you fooled around with those words? What do you mean? Okay, you're right up there. To the store, John went. How about that? Same thing. John is still the subject of the sentence. Okay, how about went John to the store? Same thing. Or John to the store went, would that be okay? Of course, it makes sense, doesn't it? But you could make nonsense of it. If you said to someone, John store to the went, they'd think it was gibberish. What's gibberish? Language that makes no sense. I had a sudden idea, a flash. I said, psychology is the study of the way people behave. Grammar is the study of the way language behaves. Go on, teacher man, tell them of your brilliant discovery, your great breakthrough. Ask, who knows what psychology is? Write the word on the board. They like big words. They take them home and intimidate their families. Psychology, who knows it? It's when people go crazy and you have to find out what's wrong with them before you put them in the loony bin. The class laughed. Yeah, like the school, man. I pushed it. If someone acts crazy, the psychologist studies them to find out what's wrong. If someone talks in a funny way and you can't understand them, then you're thinking about grammar, like John Store to the Went. So it's gibberish, right? They like that word, and I patted myself on the back for bringing it to them. News from the vast world of the English language. Teacher is bringing the news. Big breakthrough for new teacher. Gibberish. They said it to one another and laughed, but it was stuck in their heads. A few years into my teaching career, and I managed to make one word stick. 10 years from now, they'd hear gibberish and think of me. Something was happening. They were beginning to understand what grammar was. If I kept at it, I might understand it myself. The study of the way language behaves. No stopping me now. I said, store, there, to, went, John. Does that make sense? Of course not. So you see, you have to have words in the proper order. Proper order means meaning. And if you don't have meaning, you're babbling. And the men in white coats come and take you away. They stick you in the gibberish department of Bellevue. That's grammar. Ron's girlfriend, Donna, raised her hand. What about John, the first boy ever to go to jail for stealing a book on grammar? You left him up in Sing Sing with all those mean people. And what became of Rose? Did she wait for John? Was she true to him? Tough guy Ken said, nah, they never wait for you. Excuse me, said Donna, putting on a sarcastic air. I'd wait for Ron if he went to jail for robbing a grammar book. Stealing, I said. The English teacher is instructed by superiors to correct these little errors. What? Said Donna. Not robbing. The proper word is stealing. Yeah, okay. I told myself, shut up. Stop interrupting them. Who gives a fiddler's fart about the difference between stealing and robbing? Let them talk. Ken sneered at Donna. Yeah, sure, I bet you'd wait. All these guys got their asses shot off in France and Korea, and next thing they're getting Dear John letters from their girlfriends and their wives. Oh, yeah. I had to step in. All right, we're talking about John sentenced to Sing Sing for stealing a grammar book. Ken sneered again. Yeah, they're big on grammar in Sing Sing. All these killers sit around death row talking grammar all the time. Ken, I said, it's not Ron, it's John. That's right, said Donna. It's John up there, and he starts teaching everyone grammar, and they all come out of Sing Sing, talking like college professors, and the government's so grateful to John, they give him a job teaching grammar in McKee Vocational and Technical High School. Ken wanted to respond, but the class cheered and clapped and said, right on, Donna, right on, and drowned him out. English teachers say if you can teach grammar in a vocational high school, you can teach anything, anywhere. My classes listened. They participated. They didn't know I was teaching grammar. Maybe they thought we were just making up stories about John and Sing Sing, but when they left the classroom, they looked at me in a different way. If teaching could be like this every day, I might stay till I'm 80. Old Silverlock's up there, a bit bent, but don't underestimate him. Just ask him a question on the structure of the sentence, and he'll straighten his spine and tell you that story of how he brought psychology and grammar together way back in the middle of the 20th century. Mikey Dolan handed me a note from his mother explaining his absence the day before. Dear Mr. McCourt, Mikey's grandmother, who is my mother, 80 years of age, fell down the stairs from too much coffee, and I kept Mikey at home to take care of her and his baby sister so I could go to my job at the coffee shop in the ferry terminal. Please excuse Mikey, and he'll do his best in the future as he likes your class. Sincerely yours, Imelda Dolan. P.S. His grandmother is okay. When Mikey handed me the note, so blatantly forged under my nose, I said nothing. I had seen him writing it at his desk with his left hand to disguise his own handwriting, which, because of his years in Catholic primary schools, was the best in the class. The nuns didn't care whether you went to heaven or hell or married a Protestant, as long as your handwriting was clear and handsome, And if you were weak in that department, they'd bend your thumbs back till you screamed for mercy and promised a calligraphy that would open the doors of heaven. Also, if you wrote with the left hand, it was clear proof you were born with a satanic streak. And it was the business of the sisters to bend your thumbs, even here in America, land of the free and home of the brave. So there was Mikey, laboring with his left hand to disguise his exquisite Catholic calligraphy. This was not his first time forging a note, but I said nothing because most of the parental excuse notes in my desk drawer were written by the boys and girls of McKee Vocational and Technical High School, and if I were to confront each forger, I'd be busy 24 hours a day. It would also lead to indignation, hurt feelings, and strained relations between them and me. I said to one boy, "Did your mother really write this note, Danny?" He was defensive, hostile. "Yeah, my mother wrote it." "It's a nice note, Danny. She writes well." McKee students were proud of their mothers, and only a lout would let that compliment pass without thanks. He said thanks and returned to his seat. I could have asked him if the note was his, but I knew better. I liked him and didn't want him sullen in the third row. He'd tell classmates I suspected him, and that might make them sullen too, because they'd been forging excuse notes since they learned to write, and years later they didn't want to be bothered by teachers suddenly getting moral. An excuse note is just a part of school life. Everyone knows they're fiction, so what's the big deal? Parents getting kids out of the house in the morning have little time for writing notes that they know will wind up in the school garbage anyway. They're so harried they'll say, "Oh, you need an excuse note for yesterday, honey? Write it yourself and I'll sign it." They sign it without even looking at it, and the sad part is they don't know what they're missing. If they could read those notes, they'd discover their kids are capable of the finest American prose, fluent, imaginative, clear, dramatic, fantastic, focused, persuasive, useful. I threw Mikey's note into a desk drawer along with dozens of others, notes written on every size and color of paper, scrawled, scratched, stained. While my classes took a test that day, I began to read notes I'd only glanced at before. I made two piles, one for the genuine notes written by mothers, the other for forgeries. The second was a larger pile, with writing that ranged from imaginative to lunatic. I was having an epiphany. I always wondered what an epiphany would be like, and now I knew. I wondered also why I'd never had this particular epiphany before. "Isn't it remarkable," I thought, "how they resist any kind of writing assignment in class or at home? They whine and say they're busy and it's hard putting 200 words together on any subject. But when they forge these excuse notes, they're brilliant." Why? I have a drawer full of excuse notes that could be turned into an anthology of great American excuses or great American lies. The drawer was filled with samples of American talent never mentioned in song, story, or scholarly study. How could I have ignored this treasure trove, these gems of fiction, fantasy, creativity, craw-thumping, self-pity, family problems, boilers exploding, ceilings collapsing, fires sweeping whole blocks, babies and pets pissing on homework, unexpected births, heart attacks, strokes, miscarriages, robberies? Here was American high school writing at its best, raw, real, urgent, lucid, brief, lying. The stove caught fire, and the wallpaper went up, and the fire department kept us out of the house all night. The toilet was blocked, and we had to go down the street to the Kilkenny bar where my cousin works to use that toilet, but that was blocked too from the night before, and you can imagine how hard it was for my Ronnie to get ready for school. I hope you'll excuse him this one time, and it won't happen again. The man at the Kilkenny bar was very nice on account of how he knows your brother, Mr. McCord. Arnold doesn't have his work today because he was getting off the train yesterday and the door closed on his school bag and the train took it away. He yelled to the conductor, who said very vulgar things as the train drove away. Something should be done. His sister's dog ate his homework, and I hope it chokes him. Her baby brother peed on her story when she was in the bathroom this morning. A man died in the bathtub upstairs, and it overflowed and messed up all Roberta's homework on the table. Her big brother got mad at her and threw her essay out the window, and it flew away all over Staten Island, which is not a good thing because people will read it and get the wrong impression unless they read the ending, which explains everything. He had the composition you told him to write, but he was going over it on the ferry, and a big wind came and blowed it away. We were evicted from our apartment, and the mean sheriff said, if my son kept yelling for his notebook, he'd have us all arrested. I imagine the writers of excuse notes on buses, trains, ferries, in coffee shops and park benches, trying to discover new and logical excuses, trying to write as they thought their parents would. They didn't know that honest excuse notes from parents were usually dull. Peter was late because the alarm clock did not go off. A note like that didn't even merit a place in the trash can. Toward the end of the term, I typed a dozen excuse notes on a stencil and distributed them to my two senior classes. They read silently and intently. Yo, Mr. McCord, what's this? Excuse notes. What do you mean, excuse notes? Who wrote them? You did, or some of you did. I omitted the names to protect the guilty. They're supposed to be written by parents, but you and I know the real authors, yes, Mikey? So what are we supposed to do with these excuse notes? We'll read them aloud. I want you to realize this is the first class in the world ever to study the art of the excuse note, the first class ever to practice writing them. You are so lucky to have a teacher like me who has taken your best writing, the excuse note, and turned it into a subject worthy of study. They're smiling. They know. We're in this together, sinners. Some of the notes on that sheet were written by people in this class. You know who you are. You used your imagination and didn't settle for the old alarm clock story. You'll be making excuses the rest of your life, and you'll want them to be believable and original. You might even wind up writing excuses for your own children when they're late or absent or up to some devilment. Try it now. Imagine you have a 15-year-old son or daughter who needs an excuse for falling behind in English. Let it rip. They didn't look around. They didn't chew on their pens. They didn't dawdle. They were eager, desperate to make up excuses for their 15-year-old sons and daughters. It was an act of loyalty and love, and you never know, someday they might need these notes. They produce a rhapsody of excuses, ranging from a family epidemic of diarrhea to a 16-wheeler truck crashing into a house to a severe case of food poisoning blamed on the McKee High School cafeteria. They said, "More, more! Could we do more?" I was taken aback. How do I handle this enthusiasm? There was another epiphany, or a flash of inspiration, or illumination, or something. I went to the board and wrote, "For homework tonight." That was a mistake. The word homework carries negative connotations. I erased it, and they said, "Yeah, yeah." I told them, "You can start it here in class and continue at home or on the other side of the moon. What I'd like you to write is," I wrote it on the board, "an excuse note from Adam to God, or an excuse note from Eve to God." The heads went down, pens raced across paper. They could do this with one hand tied behind their backs, with their eyes closed, secret smiles around the room. "Oh, this is a good one, baby. And we know what's coming, don't we? Adam blames Eve, Eve blames Adam. They both blame God or Lucifer. Blame all around except for God, who has the upper hand and kicks them out of Eden so that their descendants wind up in McKee Vocational and Technical High School, writing excuse notes for the first man and woman, and maybe God himself needs an excuse note